Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. Wanted to let all of our listeners know that we just launched a new Facebook group for the show. It is titled simply Indoctrination Podcast Discussion Group. This group, as you may have picked up from the title, aims to serve as a space for you, the listener, to discuss weekly episodes, but also to share experiences, your own insights with fellow survivors and allies. I've been running survivor support groups for many years now, and I found that in a group setting, members often feel a sense of validation and affirmation by hearing from others who have shared similar experiences. So we hope that with this new Facebook group, we can simulate that kind of experience, at least digitally. Our social media manager, Andrew Pledger, who longtime listeners will know from his appearances as a guest on the show, will be the administrator of the group alongside me and will help to facilitate what we hope to be insightful and helpful conversations for listeners and survivors alike. We welcome anyone affected by a cult, abusive relationship, or system of control, as well as anyone interested in learning more about these topics. To join, simply click the link in the show notes of this episode or search for Indoctrination Podcast Discussion Group on Facebook. We hope to see you there. Today on the show, we have Kate West. Kate is a writer and editor based in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and her work has been published in The Revealer, Religion Dispatches, Fourth Genre, and Hawaii Pacific Review, among others. As an advocate and a survivor of the Christian patriarchy movement, she serves on the editorial board for Tears of Eden, a nonprofit providing resources for survivors of spiritual abuse. And she co-hosts the podcast Survivors Discuss. Her debut memoir, Rift, a memoir of breaking away from Christian patriarchy, releases on April 30th, 2024, pretty soon. You can find out more about Kate and her work at www.katewest.com. Here's Kate now. I am so very happy to have Kate West with me today. I would love for you to take a moment to introduce yourself, and then I have so many questions. So tell us a little bit about you and about your upcoming book called Rift.
Thanks, Rachel. It's an honor to be here, and I appreciate you asking me on your show. I think it's great. I've been listening to all your other episodes. My name is Kate West, and I am a writer and an editor. I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I work in advocacy on the side for spiritual abuse survivors through editorial work for Tears of Eden, which is a nonprofit. I also co-host a podcast called Survivors Discuss to help bring more awareness to healing after toxic religion. And I have an upcoming book called Rifts, which is a memoir of breaking away from Christian patriarchy, which describes my whole story of growing up in the Christian patriarchy movement and being a stay-at-home daughter and how I got out.
Okay, so my goodness. So there's so many things I want to talk to you about. You know, just the power, some of the things I was reading actually on your website about being able to move away from, as you said, having your story written for you to being able to write your own. And when you write your own, you can put your own words to it. You can decipher it in your own way, have your perspective on it, which is not allowed when someone else is writing your story. You can say how you feel about everything and not just accept it, but you also get to decide where it goes. which is really, really empowering. And so I love that you have turned the having the story written for you into you being an author. Now, I'm sure that was quite liberating for you.
It was. And I didn't start out that way. When I left, I wanted to completely erase the past and forget everything that had happened to me. And I wanted to study fiction writing. But once I started taking classes, my story started leaking through everything I was writing. And I realized I can't hide what happened to me. And it's a big part of who I am. And starting to write it out piece by piece was really liberating because I could take back my story and take ownership of who I am instead of be a passive participant in that.
Right. And how daring it is also to have a woman be the one to write her own story as opposed to a man deciding it for you. I'm sure that was a big part of it as well.
Yeah, because in Christian patriarchy, I'm sure you know that women are supposed to be submissive their entire lives from when they're children to their fathers. And then as soon as they get married, that submission transfers to their husband. And so I was never supposed to be able to have my own story. My whole life, I was told I was going to support a man. And no matter what his vision was, my job was to support that and help him be the best man that he could be. So my own dreams, my own visions, my own desires didn't matter in that equation.
Right. So, you know, sometimes when I'm doing work with people who have come out of these kinds of situations, just as you said, that to get a point across that somebody matters, you know, this is one of these things that I think most therapists don't think that they're going to need to address, because here they can help someone move forward and look at things in a different way. But if you don't think you matter, we have to deal with that. That's your core. That's your confidence. That's your feeling of deserving of good things too, and deserving of happiness, which is also going to be a very different value system.
Yes. And I think the idea of I matter didn't exist in my mind for the longest time. And I know that in a lot of cult recovery, we talk about the before and the after and how to get back to where you were before the cult happened to you. For me, that was from birth. So I don't have a before time when I had a sense of self. I was taught early on that self-esteem didn't matter, that I should sacrifice myself, that I should put to death myself. And so I lost that so early. I don't have an early memory of knowing that I matter in that sense. So I've had to develop that now in my 20s and 30s, which is very difficult to do.
You know, I've talked about this on the show before, but having worked with some of the women who were raised in the FLDS movement, when people are working with them and with the girls who've been married off already, when they're talking to them about helping them see that they have rights in this world, just defining the word right and what that means, and also that it is okay, it's not evil, it's not the devil, it's not something bad that you're doing to say that you have them. I mean, there are so many fundamental things that we just have to get to the root of so that you feel like you can say no, so that you have this sense that the people you can be with are people who actually listen to you, and you can decide your boundaries and they need to follow them. I mean, that I'm sure that's monumental.
Yes. And I think I'm learning that now. When I was younger, I didn't understand the words consent or autonomy or rights. And that's why when I turned 18, I did not know that I had legal rights as an adult, because I was told my parents have rights over me and I'm supposed to obey them. And so I didn't have outside information to tell me otherwise. So I assumed that I had to stay there, even though I was a legal adult. And I didn't get out of that till I was 25. So that was 7 years of my adulthood being stuck in a situation that was abusive and suppressive and kept me from following my own dreams.
Mm. So I'm curious about getting into the abuse, if you feel comfortable talking about that, because there's a reason that you're using the word in your book and, you know, on your website, escaping, that if something weren't terrible and restrictive, then you wouldn't use that word. And so even just in that choice of that word, it does give you the impression that there was something really awful happening and that you really had to really tear yourself away. You couldn't just go. You had to escape from it in a way that I'm sure took a lot of bravery, which we can hopefully talk about. So to whatever extent you feel comfortable talking about it, can you kind of paint a picture of the things that you were escaping?
I think my early childhood would match or be similar to a lot of other evangelical kids. I grew up in church and with a lot of teachings that can result in religious trauma, such as like the teaching of eternal hell, things that I became afraid of early on. That was the underlying basis of how I perceived the world, and God was this authority over me who could punish me at any moment for my wrongdoing. And just because I was born, I was sinful inherently. And so that thinking followed me all the way through my childhood. I was a very obedient child. I didn't get punished a lot. We did have, you know, corporal punishment. So I see that very differently now than I did when I was younger. I was told that was love, and I don't see it that way anymore. The abuse happened more when I became an adult because there was more manipulation. There was more control. Things that I didn't understand before started to become more clear. And that's why I use specifically spiritual abuse, because the Bible was used as this weapon to keep me under control in this house, not allowed to have a job, not allowed to like have relationships outside of my father's approval. All of those things were because of the Bible. And so it was very much tied in my idea of God and my idea of spirituality. So that's why I call that spiritual abuse. And I'm sure you know, like, spiritual abuse is tied to other kinds of abuse. So there was psychological abuse, there was emotional abuse. I consider it also financial abuse because I was prevented from having my own job or being able to support myself or have a career or learn how to have a career. So it's very complicated. And I think I try to explore that in the book because not all abuse is visible to the outside world. And the more we talk about that, the more we can help people get out of those situations.
Right. There are people I've talked to who have said, if I needed to choose, I would have chosen physical abuse, which already is showing that it's a terrible situation. You shouldn't have to ever choose that as the better of your options ever, over other kinds of abuse, because the other kind of abuse is invisible. You know, you walk around and people don't know to what extent you've been abused because they can't see it. And it can feel kind of limitless, and it also doesn't heal. And so it's a different animal.
Yeah. And I wrote in the book about how I would wish that I was physically abused as an adult so that I could go prove it to somebody to get help, because it's really difficult to get help when not a lot of people understand the sinister aspects of non-physical abuse.
Right. And so if you can describe some of those examples, because I think people are going to be able to relate to them, people who are listening, of that insidiousness, of the things that you were told, probably a lot of gaslighting about, you know, your capabilities and et cetera, et cetera. But what else do you remember really sticking with you that you've needed to work on really dispelling?
I think for me, the emotional aspect of the abuse has taken a long time to deconstruct, but it's also what helped me get out. Because when I was in my early 20s, I had a relationship, a courtship that my dad approved at the time. And things were going okay. But then behind the scenes, I was constantly being told I should repent for any feelings I had for this man, that any kind of affection was sinful, that I felt like maybe I was too happy or enjoying it too much. And so this constant suppression of my emotions, I hit this breaking point after my father ended the courtship for arbitrary reasons, in my opinion. He told me I needed to repent of my emotions. And it hit me right then. How on earth am I supposed to say I'm sorry for something I can't control. I can't control feeling love for this person. That doesn't feel wrong. It doesn't feel sinful. And so I think that was one of the first beginnings of me tapping into my intuition and understanding how I was being gaslighted and lied to about emotions, about reality.
Yeah, it does. It does. And I saw too that you went on to study Michigan State University and be able to be in a classroom, be able to use your intelligence, be able to maybe even find out that you were intelligent and to have that matter and to be able to ask a question and disagree. And, you know, I think that you've gifted yourself with these opportunities, which is really quite incredible to see what you're made of. And sometimes that has a domino effect because then you think, well, what else have I been told about myself? That's just not true. It served them to have me believe it, but it's just not true. So I wonder what you have found over the last few years that is really true about you that no one had told you before.
I think that my intuition is not inherently evil, that I don't have this inherent evilness that is who I am. I think that I make mistakes and I can do things for wrong motivations, but that doesn't make me a bad person. I think my empathy can lead me to make better decisions, and having a balance between logic and emotion and intuition instead of just this is what the Bible says and that's what you should do, period. Having my own discernment, which I hate that word now, but it's true. Like I can judge things and make decisions, which is what's really difficult to start doing. And then I can change my course depending on how those decisions work out. So I make mistakes. I learn from them. Doesn't make me a failure. And I can grow from that instead of feeling shame and feeling like I'm constantly disobeying God.
I love what you just brought up about making mistakes. When you're raised in these environments, from all that I've been told, it's like there's this watchful eye over you. And then you develop this reputation and it sticks. And it shouldn't, because as people are growing up, even in their young adult years, most, and I'm thinking even now, a lot of what I do is trial and error. Like, well, okay, well, it was worth a shot. So, and that's how you learn. But if you have someone watching you and deciding that this means something about you and it sticks forever in terms of, you know, reputationally, you're not going to take risks. It's not safe to, you know, you can't dispel this mythology that then is developed about you when you're just learning things for the first time. And so how nice that you're giving yourself that opportunity just to be a human being and try things out and be wrong, and it's okay.
Yeah. And I think part of that is being able to talk with other people. I think I was so isolated that, you know, I'm stuck in my own head. I'm stuck with all these rules. And once that broke down and I got out, I was able to go to college and I started working for the college and the writing center. And I got to meet all these people from different backgrounds because I was at a community college first, and I just got to sit there and listen to their stories and realized these people aren't bad people. I was told that the outside world was evil and nobody was following truth or had good ethics. And I just met so many good people who had unique stories. And it broadened my horizon so much because I got out of myself and realized my story is unique, their stories are unique, and they all matter. And that was such a powerful thing for me to learn is our stories do matter. They make us who we are, and we can decide what to do in our futures because of that.
Right. And so I want us to talk a little bit more just about these movements that you were involved with before we talk about you leaving them, I think, just so to do the educational piece about the organization that you were involved in and the whole stay-at-home daughter movement, et cetera. But first, just when you're talking about writing and becoming you, I love the idea that you use a pseudonym, but it's a very meaningful one. And if you can talk about that for a moment, that would be great. And then we'll go more into your history.
Sure. My first name is my real name. My last name that I use is West, and that is a family name on my mother's side. So it's not my legal last name. I didn't want to use the name I was born with, and I didn't want to use my married name, my husband's name, because I'm writing about patriarchy and taking back my power. And it just felt wrong to use a name that signified patriarchy in our broader society. And I know that it's such a complicated thing and that people have different opinions about this, but for me as a writer, my writing self, I wanted to have my own name. And it's interesting because I chose my grandmother's maiden name, but at the same time, I understand that was her father's name, right? So in our society, we can't escape the patriarchal influence, but it's a gesture for me to reach into some kind of matrilineal line of heritage, even though it's not perfect.
Mm-hmm. I like being able to think about you aligning with the parts of your family and history that speak to you and being able to connect and kind of further that name down the road by having it be one that you're using now and you're going to be known for to a great degree, especially after the book comes out. But, you know, I think about how many times women are made invisible and, you know, that they need to stand behind their man. They need to become the housewife, which is a term that just gives me chills. But I think about even my mom. I mean, she's a force to be reckoned with, you know, an Ivy League grad, heads of major organizations, but she became Mrs. and then my father's name and my father's last name, even lost her first name. And that was really fascinating to see when I would see, she saves everything. So she has these old letters and stuff. And I thought, who is that? Like, who is that? Is that grandma? Is that like, who is, she goes, no, that's me, but I'm not represented in anything except for the S at the end of Mr. that they added the S for me. That's the only representation of me, which is so interesting.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's broader than just, you know, I keep saying that I grew up in a fringe movement or what people would call fringe, but patriarchal issues exist throughout society and different religions and secular society. So it's not just isolated to me and my experience. I think these ideas need to be talked about for everybody.
Right. So tell us a little bit about these movements in general. I mean, just thinking about, you know, that people have heard a little bit about Quiverful. They've heard maybe on this podcast a little bit about stay-at-home daughters. How long have these movements been around? Because I'm sure you've done some deep dive into that too.
I think our modern conception of purity culture goes back to the evangelical response to the sexual revolution and feminism. And I think we can trace that back in time. The movement I was part of started in the 90s, the Christian patriarchy movement. And perhaps some of those people started in the 80s talking about this ideology. And it's the ideology that men are God's chosen leaders of society, of church, and of family. And the father is specifically the leader of their home. And in this ideology, the father is a kind of Jesus figure of being a priest, a king, and a prophet to his family. So there's this authority structure built into this ideology. It's very similar to Bill Gothard and IBLP. I wasn't personally part of that, but I was part of groups that were influenced by Bill Gothard's teachings. So when I was younger, when I was a young child, we went to what you would think of as an average Presbyterian church and normal things that you would think of, like Sunday school, vacation Bible school, friends at church. But the older I got, my family got pulled deeper into more extreme views. We started getting this magazine called Patriarch Magazine. And it specifically taught this ideology that men are the leaders and women need to submit. And this went on for years, this magazine. And I think it impacted a lot of people because it had articles from different leaders in the movement. And eventually Vision Forum started. And I'm not sure if you've heard of a Vision Forum, but it was a ministry and it was a business, a catalog business that supported this idea of a godly family where the father is the head of the household, the mother is the helpmeet, and the children are what you would call the arrows and the quiver, which is where Quiverful comes from. And so my family got into that, and my father took my brother to a retreat. And after that, our lives really dramatically changed. I got pulled out of Sunday school. We stopped going to our church at the time and started going to a patriarchal church. And it just got more extreme as I got older. So the rules started changing. Like, now you're not going to ever have a job. You're never going to go on dates. You're only going to get married through a courtship process through my father. And that happened over time, incrementally. I can see how my father specifically got into this because of his personality. But I do see how insidious these teachings are, because you can start with just a book or just a conference, and then it pulls you in. And before you know it, you're keeping your adult children from being independent.
Right. I wonder how your mom took this shift. I don't know if it was decided on by your father solely, or if she was part of the decision as well.
My father was the decision maker. That was clear from the beginning. And my mother, I think she wanted to obey God, and she was being told that meant obeying her husband. So she didn't push back that I could see on these things. And I know now she regrets that, and she sees things differently now. But at the time, you know, we have bounded choice, right? We don't have a lot of choices when you're in this kind of a family and this kind of a church. So she didn't have a lot of choices about what we could do.
And how many kids are there in the family?
There's four of us.
Okay. How many girls and how many boys were there?
Two girls and two boys, which in the church that we started going to, the patriarchal one, was a very small family. So a lot of my friends came from bigger families.
Okay. But I like that there's this difference, right, in genders, because my next question was, how did it suddenly become more different for your brothers than it was for you and your sister?
Yeah. So my older brother left home at the age of 17 to join the army because he didn't, well, I'm sure he has his own reasons and I don't want to tell his own story, but I mean, our family wasn't a welcoming place, as you know. So he left at 17 and we did lose contact with him for a few years. And for me and my sister, we stayed home till our 20s before we got married as stay-at-home daughters. My sister's 9 years older than me, so I watched her go through all of that first. And my younger brother was one of the first ones to start pushing against the rules. He was allowed to have a job. He was allowed to go to the community college and take some classes. He was encouraged to be more like an entrepreneur. And I was kept at home to learn homemaking skills and support whatever my dad wanted me to do. So my brother, while he still was existing, my younger brother, while he was still existing in this oppressive environment, he did have a little more freedom than I did.
Okay, interesting. Right. And so also with your brother, your older brother going away, and right, this is not to speak for him, but I do think it's interesting when you go away and you're not in contact at all. There is something that some people really need to do, and they really need to separate themselves out and just be in the world without any kind of influence, without needing to answer for anything or to anyone, and just really be independent, and also to see if you can. So it can really be an interesting watershed moment for people.
Yeah. And I think for me, I was the younger I was younger than him and my older sister. And so watching them exist in this framework and go their different ways through this, him leaving and my sister staying and getting married through courtship, I learned a lot by witnessing that. And I learned what would happen if I left, to the consequences of leaving the family was potentially no communication, potentially not having a family anymore. I think that's part of why I stayed for so long, was I knew what would happen if I tried to push back on the boundaries.
Right. Okay. And I do want to talk about you getting married, but before, I want to say something about something I also saw and something that you wrote about how your family appeared to be happy. So many of the people I talk to on the podcast and clients I have will say, you know, don't be fooled by picture perfect families, that they have learned to come across a certain way so they make their family look good. And they also think this is how God wants them to act. But if, you know, I think it would be alarming to anyone who knows about child development, who understands about psychology, family dynamics, to see like a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old sitting perfectly still, not wiggling, not doing anything for hours during a service, or being admonished for crying or being hungry or needing to take care of their basic needs, so that everyone can look just perfect and perfectly happy. And it is never the case that they're happy. You just learn to not say what's on your mind, not express yourself. And there's so much fear also in that picture that doesn't come across on people's faces, but you can just tell they're doing things that are not typical for what would be expected at that developmental stage. And to control people, you usually have to, you know, use fear as the tool, which is to do to kids. So I wonder what you notice either in your family or other families that would make everyone appear happy and just perfect.
I think a lot about this one family in our church who had little kids, and they were the perfectly behaved children, like the most perfect behaved children in the church. And they would sit through, you know, 2-2.5 hour worship services, not moving. And I remember the mom telling us that was because she trained them in the week. She would go home, she would put a sermon on the stereo, make her children sit in chairs and listen to it. And if they left the chairs, she would punish them, which I'm presuming was spanking. That was taught openly in our church, was discipline is spanking. And so that's why they were so controlled. They had all of this pressure at home to obey, but they never seemed like normal children to me because they didn't express themselves loudly at all. They didn't have any obvious emotions, but their family was really put together, and like they seemed like a nice family and, you know, well-dressed and well-behaved. But I think about them now because I grieve over the way those children were treated. And sometimes it's easier for me to think about the other children than it is to think about myself as a child, because I was controlled in very much the same way. And fear was a big part of my upbringing. Fear of losing family, fear of losing God's love, fear of losing my whole community if I disobeyed. And dealing with that fear, it's difficult when you learn that from such an early age. But back to you, what you were asking about being happy, I feel like in my family, my father was a church leader. He was an elder in several churches over the years. And I always felt like we had to be good models to the rest of the church. And I was held up as a good model as a daughter who was waiting for marriage. And I remember my dad would teach classes about courtship. And my sister was an example because she went through one. And I was an example because I was going to go through one. And so there's all this pressure of keeping the family together, keeping the family well established in the church. I didn't think of it in those terms, but I mostly just wanted to make my dad happy.
Right. So it's hard also when your parent is a leader of any sort that you're held up to an even more stringent I think, you know, requirement to be an example and to make that parent look good and like they've been able to take care of things at home. So they are able to teach this to the community. And so I wonder about your courtship and your marriage. Tell us about that.
Well, I had a courtship when I'm in my early 20s. I had a courtship when I was in my early 20s, and it was very long, and my father controlled every aspect of it. We went through a courtship guide, which I talk about a lot in my book. I quote a lot of passages from it because you can still get it online. And he would ask me and this man these questions every week, and we would talk about them with my dad. And then we had chaperoned time, usually on Sundays after church, to spend together. But we never really had alone time. My dad put an end to that courtship for reasons I get to in the book. And I was heartbroken after that. And I didn't want that to ever happen to me again. And so I thought to myself, well, first I started thinking about how to leave by myself, which is very difficult when you don't have a lot of things. I don't think I even had access to my birth certificate at the time. So leaving by myself would have been difficult. And then I was also thinking, if there's another person that I would ever want to be with, I'm not going to let this happen again. I'm not going to let my dad ruin that relationship because this is the rest of my life. So that was going on in my head for a few years while I was trying to figure out how to be a stay-at-home daughter. What do I really want? You know, struggling with this cognitive dissonance and this internal conflict of who I was and what I wanted to do with my life. And that's when I met somebody new, which I talk about in the book quite a bit. And he and I used to play music at church together, and we fell in love. And my father said yes to our relationship for about a week and then changed his mind and decided that we couldn't have a relationship until certain goals were met, which would have been a few years away. I'm talking like financial goals. So we couldn't have a relationship at all. I was not happy about that. And we ended up having a somewhat secret romantic relationship and got to the point where I was ready to elope with him. And it's a long story, which is why I've written a whole book about this. But over time, we decided to get married against my dad's wishes. And I moved out and moved to Michigan, which is where my husband's originally from. And we got married and I started my life over, and I wanted to just start new and have nothing to do with my past. That's not how it worked out, but that was my hope at the time. That was 10 years ago at this point. So I've been out for 10 years and I'm really happy that I married my best friend instead of waiting for my father to approve some arbitrary relationship. You know, who knows when that would have happened, because it felt like he was keeping me from having any relationship at all.
Right. And the financial kind of goals, that did that feel arbitrary, or was that something that was part of church teaching?
I think it was pretty arbitrary, because the first courtship, I don't remember a specific number ever being said. And then this second courtship, this 1 week long courtship, it was like, now you have to have a specific number, a specific amount of money in the bank that he would have to have in order to have a courtship, not even to marry me, but just to have a relationship at all. So yeah, it wasn't feasible. We were young and we lived in Hawaii at the time. There wasn't a university there to get a higher education. So we were in a sticky place.
Right. And so then when you left, I know you were talking before about the worry about leaving and that the fear that you were given about needing to then have to say goodbye to family, to friends, to everyone. What did happen when you left?
When I left, I was 25 and I was moving to Michigan to get married. Another factor that comes into play is the man I married was the son of the pastor of our church at the time. So that complicated things a lot for my dad, who was an elder in the church. And I think that is why once I went against my dad's will, he kind of backed off a little bit. And he when I was living in his house, he would use threats and try to convince me not to do this. But once I left, he pretended like nothing had ever happened. He came to the wedding, which was in Michigan, not where my parents lived. And I thought maybe we could have a relationship. Over time, that stopped being true, because once I started talking about what had happened, then he decided that he didn't want a relationship with me anymore. So it's a long time of leaving and then finding my voice. And once I found my voice, that's when the cutting off actually happened.
Ah, okay. And when you found your voice, what did you find yourself saying?
I wanted to tell the truth. Once I left, I was experiencing all these PTSD symptoms. I was struggling with my mental health and trying to make ends meet. You know, I didn't have any work experience to help me get work, and it was difficult just to survive. And I wanted to be a writer, and I was listening to someone speak and say to speak up for injustice and help those who were being harmed by others. And so for me, that meant all the people I left behind who were still in the Christian patriarchy movement, who were still stay-at-home daughters. And I had changed my mind about so much. I felt like it was my responsibility to start talking about it. And my first time talking about it, I shared about how my father would monitor my dress, my clothing, and take me to stores and make me try on stuff for him, and how invasive that felt. And especially as I got older, in sharing that online, even though it was under a pseudonym, obviously didn't make my father very happy. And he sees things very differently. So he was upset about that. And I tried to reach out to him and explain what I believed had happened and what I believe now about how it was wrong and abusive. And that's the last time we had spoken. He hasn't contacted me directly since then.
How long ago was that?
That was 2019.
Okay. So what's it been like to not have contact with him?
I think in many ways, my anxiety around certain dates, like holidays and birthdays, has gone down, because I don't have this expectation of I'm going to see him or I'm going to talk to him, because I was experiencing a lot of anxiety. Any contact before that, just because he's never acknowledged his part in what happened. He's never acknowledged wrongdoing. He's never said he's sorry. And he keeps saying that he was following God. So to me, it's hard to get past that. And I was willing to work things out with him, but he wasn't willing to take responsibility for his part of things. And once we stopped talking, it felt like this burden was released from me, that I could tell more of my story, that I could share things without fear. At the same time, it's come with a lot of grief, because I don't have a healthy, stable relationship with him. I don't have any relationship with him anymore. And that's sad for me. I've come to terms with it, but it doesn't make it easier in some ways. But in other ways, you know, I'm able to be my whole self without his influence or power over me anymore.
Right. Okay. When people say, well, they were just following God, I wonder, I mean, I look at it sarcastically, unfortunately, in my head, but I think, if you believe in God and God is in charge of the universe, I would wonder if God had the time to give your dad the instruction to take you clothes shopping, because that seems very specific and irrelevant. But to think about those moments that might seem like just kind of random examples, there's something so powerful about them. First of all, it is very uncomfortable to think about that. Yes, there are people who go shopping with their dads all the time, but they're not necessarily being evaluated for their modesty. You know, I mean, that's a whole other thing. But also the impression that it can give the girls and women who are going through this is they need a man to tell them when what they're doing is appropriate or not. Left to their own devices, making their own decisions, they would make the wrong ones. And so it's another example of probably what you needed to do a lot of when you left, which was taking your power back, saying, I can trust me. I also can evaluate what I'm going to use to define me or not, that if I'm wearing a short skirt or a long skirt, it doesn't change my character. And I could still be a good person, whatever that means. So it's a very powerful thing when people have their sense of independence really tampered with. I think about sometimes with fellow parents I know who also raised kids who would always have these tracking devices on their kids' phones and computers and need to check and make sure that they knew where they were at all times and talk to the other parents they were with at all times. And I thought, what impression does that give? I mean, unless you have a child really who has an issue, who, you know, where you really do need to monitor them. And then I understand that. But by and large, I tried at least to tell my kids, I have no reason to not trust you. You're great. Like, if you make a bad decision, you'll make a bad decision. You'll learn from it. If you want me to know where you are because you're nervous going to a new place or with a new person, then let me know. I'm happy to check. But I'll leave that up to you. Like, you tell me what you need. I'm not going to decide it for you. And I think then people rise to the occasion. You know, they're like, oh, I have a parent who trusts me. I don't want to let them down, actually. Wasn't even thinking about that as a manipulation, but it just sometimes happens, you know? And some kids will also say, well, my parent doesn't trust me anyway. So what's the point of even trying? You know, it's an interesting head game.
Yeah, I think for a while I was the trusted kid in the family because I was very obedient. I had seen what had happened to my older siblings. And I think my father did put a lot of trust in me. That's partly why the backlash when I did push against the boundaries, when I did say, I still want to have this relationship, even though you don't want me to, you know, that backfired a little bit because all of a sudden I had turned rebellious. I was now this, my dad would call me this rebellious feminist who just didn't obey. And he would call me things like that and yell at me. And things really escalated from there of how he was treating me. And over time, it's interesting that you talk about what that feels like to be monitored and seen and judged by a man and told what to wear. This resulted in me being so dissociated through a lot of my life that I'm still struggling with, like, embodiment and learning to be in my body and see myself instead of seeing myself from a man's perspective. I was constantly thinking about, what do I look like to a man? Am I tempting? Am I distracting? Am I attractive? Instead of thinking about, what do I want to be and what do I want to look like? So the point that, you know, I've struggled with recognizing myself in photographs, and I'm working on embodiment practices to help me get over that, because my whole life I was told that myself didn't matter except for how I was viewed by a man. So it really is insidious. The way it does, what it does to your mind.
Mm-hmm. And it's another example of how this is also true in mainstream society to a great degree, like women who are attacked and then ask, well, what were you wearing? You know, and somehow did you ask for it just because of the length of a skirt or the whatever. I came across this great quote last year. It wasn't attributed to anyone. So if anyone knows who says it, please let me know, because I want to be able to give credit where it's due. But it was that women's bodies are not responsible for men's thoughts. And I loved it. And it just shows that here you're in your little microcosm, you're going to have something that is not necessarily totally unique, unfortunately. And it mirrors some of the problems in outside society, but it's so ramped up that it's like you can't get away from it. So I understand the dissociation when you're in something and it feels so oppressive. That is our brain's way of protecting us. Right. And getting that back where you realize you don't need it anymore as a tool is easier said than done.
That's true. Yeah. And it, but it's worth it. You know, I think that's taken me a lot of years of therapy and trauma specific therapy to work through some of these things and realizing how that mind body connection works, but also using that to think back of the past and how that was used against me. Because if my mind body connection was disintegrated, I was easier to control. I was easier to kept in these bounds of what they thought a godly woman should be. Now that I'm feeling more embodied and more empowered in my own voice, I'm not as easy to control.
Right. Right. And so now I'm wondering about your relationship, because the relationship you have, I'm sure, is very different than the one you were raised to have. So how is it different?
Well, I think both of us, we started off when we got married, we still went to church after I left my family, and we went to a church that would have been considered complementarian, which means that women still submit to their husbands. But we never interacted together that way. And so it felt like this pressure to be a marriage that we never wanted and that we never treated each other alike. We've always had mutual respect, mutual love. It never was, he needs respect and I need love. It was more balanced than that. And we both have worked from the beginning and provided for our shared household. And that's, that in itself is very different from how I grew up. But also, partly why I married him was because he respected my opinion, my ideas. He wanted to know what I was thinking. Almost no one had ever asked me what I thought about things before. And so it was such a contrast to have somebody in my life who cared about what I thought as if I was a person.
As though you were a person, because you were, but it clearly shows how you felt and how you were treated, that you were less than, not fully formed in some way. Right. How interesting. So I want to ask you if there are other parts of your history that you wanted to let us know about, that I didn't mean to rush you through things or past things, if there were other things that you wanted to make sure to talk about.
One thing is, I didn't talk about so far is homeschooling. I was homeschooled since I was pulled out of kindergarten when I was a kid. And homeschooling helped keep me isolated in this way. So I think I'm really passionate about children's rights now, and that children have access to mandatory reporters, to information, to libraries. I've seen an increase in homeschooling since the pandemic. And it's a little troubling because much of the homeschooling curriculum is based in fundamentalist Christianity. And so I think people can easily fall into these ideas without even knowing it. And so I want to keep talking about this experience so that children still need to be advocated for. There's still many children being homeschooled who don't have access to mandatory reporters. They don't have government regulations to protect them in most cases. And so something I like to shout out is the Coalition for Responsible Home Education, because they advocate for laws to be passed to protect children who are homeschooled. I'm not anti-homeschooling, but I do think that children deserve to have access to their own rights, to information, and to outside resources, particularly mental health resources. So I just want to shout out that. And then also, I've become increasingly concerned about patriarchal ideology filtering into politics the past few years. Somebody like Mike Pence would have fit in very well in my previous churches as someone who is patriarchal, who is has very strict rules about gender. And I see this happening in a lot of ways in our government. And that's concerning to me, that this kind of teaching is becoming more mainstream than it was when I was a kid. So I just wanted to say that, because I think it's something we need to keep looking out for.
Right. Absolutely. So tell us about sort of the size of that and what you're noticing, because that's not something I'm as familiar with. I mean, it doesn't surprise me, unfortunately. And, you know, there have been a lot of groups that have made their way into school curriculums, like even Scientology has had books that have been accepted, right, in certain school systems. And I think, oh, wow, that's dangerous. But there are, yeah, there are a lot of bits of education that are infused with kinds of teachings that are problematic. I think about the Waldorf schools as well, that a lot of people don't realize it has a cultic base, you know. So tell us more about that piece. What have you learned about that? And then I want to go back to homeschooling for a moment.
This is a very complex situation because, like, for instance, I say Christian patriarchy movement. A lot of people who believe that might not use that term. And it's easy to dismiss people that way by saying, oh, I'm not part of that group or whatever, but they still believe the same things. I'm seeing people get into government who, for instance, our new Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, has very clearly talked about how he believes the Bible is the root of his worldview and how that's the basis for what he believes should happen. That's a very Christian nationalist thing to say. That's how I was taught to be as a kid. And so to have that so high up in our government is very concerning, because the way I was taught, it doesn't really matter what other people believe, because we believed the truth, right? We believed God and the Bible. And if everybody followed that, everyone would be happy, right? So it's almost this direction toward a theocracy rather than a democracy where there's different belief systems at play. And so that's concerning to me, because it means that these leaders are willing to override people's rights in the same way that my rights were overrided. So for instance, like trans people and LGBT people, they're willing to negate their rights in order to push their own worldview. It's very concerning about women's rights and bodily autonomy. That's very concerning to me. I see this in just so many different areas. And so I am concerned in the direction, but I think we keep talking about it. If we keep speaking up about our own experiences in these kinds of groups and these teachings and how the teachings result in harm, then we can prevent this from hurting other people, hopefully.
It is incredible. I think I'm glad you brought up about him, about this new Speaker of the House. So Kelly Johnson runs a counseling business that in its operating documents compares being gay to, among other things, having sex with a family member or animal, bestiality, and that they are involved, yeah, kind of together in this company that does conversion therapy. I mean, it is pretty scary, actually. Also, because he comes across as this kind of dude, you know, like an everyman, and he's so nice and whatever. But his views, I mean, I heard him talking about how he blamed homosexuality on the fall of the Roman Empire. Okay, what? So, you know, you just go, okay, when this can be endless, right? That people can be blamed for things. And maybe it wasn't such a bad thing that there was the end of the Roman Empire anyway, right? Like, why is he, you know, shedding tears over that? They had a good run, but still wasn't because of gay people. What? It's so nuts. Anyway, I shouldn't say it's nuts. That's not very professional, but still it feels that way. Like, oh, I'm just going to pull stuff out of the sky. So, right, to fit my bias.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's people who make careers on that. I think the name David Barton has come up recently as a historian who's influenced people like Mike Johnson, and he's not a real historian. He tells a false view of history. He's been debunked by actual historians, but he's teaching these ideas of, like, of Christianity and how it's, you know, been throughout history. I grew up reading his books in homeschooling, and now he's still in the news, right? So this kind of thing isn't new, unfortunately.
And our Supreme Court Justice, who, you know, she was a handmaid, right? Talk about that as a title. And I there's someone in my support group who was involved in the same organization that she was raised in. And she said it gives her chills to hear her speak because she recognizes that tone. There's a very kind of self-satisfied, distant tone, like you have the answer. You don't need to get ruffled by anything. So, right. And moving back, you know, from the Supreme Court justice and who knows how much is getting infused in these days with people who are raised with these teachings. It is frightening to me. Homeschooling is an interesting thing. I mean, I have this background in special ed where I know that there are some kids who just have a very hard time in school settings. But I also know that when I was a school counselor for a while, there were some parents who didn't like this, that the school had oversight into what was happening at home. And they would take the child out of school and say, we're going to homeschool them now, which was frightening because then you knew they were just saying, we want to do whatever we want to do, which was frightening. So I wonder how it was for you when you were homeschooled and then, you know, going off to college, like what, if you felt there were things that you just didn't learn along the way that you needed to catch up with.
I think my personality meant that I learned pretty well as a homeschooled kid. I'm generally a quiet person. I've always liked reading and I can sit by myself and do things for long periods of time. And I think that homeschooling gave me an opportunity to, you know, study on my own, to take my time, all sorts of things that homeschooling can help with. However, I didn't have much of a social aspect. And so when I left, I struggled with interacting with people my own age. When I went to college, I was older than everybody. And even getting into college was difficult because I didn't have any high school transcripts. I've never taken the SAT or the ACT. So I had to write my own transcripts from memory and submit those in order to just enroll in community college. So there's a lot of hurdles when you grow up that way if you're not prepared for college. I think some homeschooled families do prepare their kids for college. In my family, that wasn't allowed. So it wasn't on the table. But that's why regulations are important so that children know what the options are as they get older and that they can access mandatory reporters when there's abuse happening at home. I think homeschooling can be a good thing, but a lot of times abusive parents take their children out of school because they can homeschool them without any consequences for the abuse that happens. We've seen this time and again, and it's really distressing. So I think that's why we need more oversight, more regulations for these kids, or at least to have contact with the outside world in certain ways so that they aren't alone.
Right. Really good point. Really good point. There is so much to talk about, so much more to talk about. And I know there's a lot more that people will be learning from you when your book comes out. And I would love for you to tell people where they can find you and your blog and all of it. So go for it.
Sure. I have a website, katewest.com, and I spell my first name C-A-I-T. My last name is W-E-S-T. And that's where you can find the most information about me. I have links for my upcoming book, which is coming out April 30th. And I also have a Substack newsletter, so you can find me on Substack. And I try to keep updated on Instagram and Threads and Facebook as much as I can. And I also have a podcast now with a couple friends. It's called Survivors Discuss. And so we have discussions about dealing with religious trauma. And so far we've had episodes about embodiment, and we're having an episode about complex PTSD. So we're trying to tackle things that we're experiencing as survivors and trying to make it helpful for other people going through those similar things.
So important. And thank you so much for sharing about your life. I know that it's going to be a powerful thing for people to hear what you went through. A lot of people are going to be able to relate to it, but also that you've come out from it still healing, still, you know, working on the messaging that you got that was repeated and also infused with fear, which gives it more sticking power at times. And so that can be a long journey, but still doable, but that your life is just so much better and that you have been able to access and use your voice and telling your story and also creating your story the way you want it to be, which is really quite lovely. Thank you so much for today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rachel.
My pleasure.
One more thing before you go. I am always so moved by talking to people like Kate. I think about her life growing up, how limited it was, and how limiting it was, and how it could have been that way forever. But she chose to not let the constrictions of her environment keep her imprisoned. There is this sort of strange feeling, response I have to this whole notion of stay-at-home daughter. The whole stay-at-home daughter movement, it might work for some families, but it really is about keeping the woman, the girl, locked away, sequestered, being a housewife. And it is very interesting, too, because when I do counseling and I talk to people who have chosen to be stay-at-home moms and stay-at-home dads, the important part of that sentence is chosen. They've chosen this role either because it works better financially or because one person doesn't have work to go to quite yet, so they're choosing that, or it is just really what their wish is. And if someone is relegated to that and it isn't their choice, they're usually quite unhappy. But hopefully things will shift for them and they'll be able to then make a change, get a job, find someone for childcare, do something that works within the relationship and make that shift. You have that choice and you have that freedom most of the time. But with being a stay-at-home daughter, that is not a choice. It is something that is a designation that is imposed on you. And so it doesn't come from that place of deciding. But it is a huge, huge shift in your life if, as you're growing up, you're learning things, you're making friends, you're developing, you're getting a sense a little bit more of independence, which is part of the natural process of going through developmental stages and social stages within your life. But within the confines of the Christian patriarchy, you have the walls closing in on you. So even though internally you're probably wanting to break free, you're wanting to see what you're capable of, you're wanting to do all the things that your nature is going to drive you to want to do, and then you're told, mm-mm, you can't go anywhere. You can't do anything. You can't explore anything about yourself intellectually, in terms of work experience. Your job has been decided for you. Your persona has been decided for you. Your role and your rights or lack thereof have been decided for you. It would be a little more tolerable to me if there were also stay-at-home sons. But until there is kind of equal measure of oppression, I suppose, right? Stay-at-home daughters and stay-at-home sons. It's a whole other level of wrong in my head that someone can't become something outside in the world, but it's only the girls. It doesn't surprise me. These are the stories we often hear. And these are the things that make people who decide to leave at some point not know who they are. And when they really want to break free, they don't feel able to be in the world quite yet. They might not have been able to go on with their education. They might not know what their rights are even. They might not know what their preferences are. They have to learn to speak up for themselves. They have to learn to make connections with the world. They have to learn that it's not evil for them to want something for themselves, for them to want freedom, for them to want to be able to share a thought. It was so moving to hear Kate say that her husband was the first person who asked her opinion about anything. If you are a stay-at-home daughter, your opinion, it seems, then doesn't matter. But it should. It should be that you have a say, but I guess that would interfere with the order of things. That would make it a little too messy if they give everyone rights. But if you're involved in an organization where it is too messy to give everyone rights, then I think you want to rethink your involvement in this organization. I love that Kate was able to find someone who was able to say something to her that probably felt like just kind of an everyday question, but probably landed on her like a ton of bricks. What do you think about this? What is your opinion? When someone asks for your opinion, they're saying, I care about what you think, and I respect what you think. Those are very, very important places to come from in a relationship, but those are very, very important things to be able to feel that someone else is really understanding that you have something to share and that you have something to teach. And they're going to assess maybe their own opinion and mix it with yours and then come up with some kind of a decision. But it shows that you're an equal. And unfortunately, for many people raised in those environments, they never get to feel that. Thank you so much to Kate for all that she's doing to get the word out and all the healing she's been able to take us through and the steps of how to get there. And to highlight those moments again that might not seem like a big deal if you haven't been subjugated, but they are a very big deal when someone suddenly says, what happens in your head matters to me. I'm going to give it credit. I'm going to give it credence. I'm going to give it importance. And it can feel so good and so reassuring that your thoughts matter to someone else. Thank you so much to Kate. Take care, everyone.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.